All right, let's see if this works this time. That seems to be working. Good. And this one? All right, testing. Okay, so another one of the places that I haunt during the summer, my family, for many years, we used to go up to the northern Catskills. Actually, it was the eastern Catskills. You know, a lot of people go like to the Borscht Belt, which is sort of the west side of the Catskills. But there's really an unknown, well, it was unknown until a couple of years ago, the eastern part of the Catskills, which is near, there's a ski area called Hunter Mountain. And near that is another community called Tannersville. And both Hunter Mountain and Tannersville have a shul. Tannersville is much more developed because they have a kosher store and they have a day camp and they have a lot of Jewish facilities. And generally, the German Jewish community went up there for many years and then it was discovered. So now a lot of very traditional people spend the summers there. And we used to take our children up there because it was a real intensive Jewish experience. It was really nice. These ski chalets were half the price of what they used to rent for on the other side of the mountain. It was a great experience for us. So we used to rent an apartment for the 2 months of the summer. And I used to come up for weekends. And when I was educational director, I used to come up for a couple of weeks at a time before we started NJOP. At the end of the summer, I used to go to meet with Mr. Prince, who was the owner of our house, and used to negotiate the terms for the next summer. So I went to see Mr. Prince, and just to give you an idea of what kind of estate he lived on a beautifully manicured estate with about a driveway of about 200 yards. Parked in the driveway were probably like five of the most recent, fanciest, most expensive cars. He had a place back in Boca. He had an Olympic pool. It was a stone house that he lived in with a 30-foot high chimney right near a bubbling brook. And it was just magnificent, just magnificent. So I went to see Mr. Prince, and he was occupied, and his wife greeted me, and we were sitting on the porch. And she said, you know, why don't you have a seat? We'll talk. And she starts talking to me. And after a while, she says to me, you know, Rabbi, this country stinks. This country stinks. I looked around at the cars in the driveway, the babbling brook, you know, the pool in the front, the manicured lawn. And I said, Mrs. Prince, how can you say a thing like that? She says, well, a couple of years ago, we bought our daughter a condo on the Upper East Side. We went to visit her, and someone broke into the trunk of our Mercedes and stole everything. And this was just like just a couple of weeks ago. And then 2 weeks later, we went to visit her again, and they stole the whole car. This country stinks. So it like left an impression upon me, you know, that a person who seemed to be, you know, so affluent and so successful would like condemn the whole country, you know, because someone stole her car. And then a couple of weeks later, I was driving in a taxi cab, and it was a Jewish taxi cab driver who owned a couple of cabs, you know, so he wasn't a poor person. He came from Valley Stream, and, you know, we start talking, and he finds out that I'm a rabbi, and he says to me, you know, Rabbi, my daughter just got married recently, and she just announced to me that they don't plan on having children. I must tell you that my first reaction was that I was very, very, very sad because I want so much to be a grandfather. But frankly, you know, seeing what this world is like, you know, probably it's better that they not bring more children into this world. And the confluence of those two remarks, you know, from relatively successful, wealthy people, and the sense of morose, the sense of depression, the sense of unhappiness just struck me. It was a malaise, this attitude of malaise that I just couldn't understand. Now, I have many, many, many vices. You'll have to wait for my public admissions when I speak to the New York Times about my public vices. But one of the vices that I have is that I'm a clipper. I'm a clipper. You guys don't know what a clipper is, right? You know, what's a clipper?
clip articles and keep.
I keep what? I clip what?
Clip articles and keep.
I clip articles and I keep them. Very good. Okay. Okay, she's a very wise woman. I am a clipper of articles when I used to read the newspapers. Now who reads the newspapers, okay? Now you just, cut and copy and paste and you put them into the files. But I used to like keep newspapers, for months and months and months until I got around to clip the articles. My wife wanted to throw me and the newspapers out. And I used to put them into categories. And one of the categories that I liked, and this is probably a reflection about me, it was like crime statistics, you know. So I have a couple of clippings that I've saved that I'd like to just read to you. One out of every six American children under 18 lives in a step family. By the year 2000, that proportion will grow to 1 in 4, government studies estimate, okay? So one out of six, and this was in early 1900s, by the year 2000, it will be 1 in 4 live in a step family. About a third of American families experience domestic violence. At least 1.8 million women are assaulted by their husbands every year, and more than 1.6 million children are abused by their parents. Polls taken by the Roper Organization show that the number of families that eat dinner together declined 10%. It says that the study found that the majority of those younger than 12 prepare at least one and sometimes more than seven meals a week. And this, of course, is because of, from the frozen dinners, that we were talking about before. 1 in 4 American women will become a victim of rape or attempted rape. 1 out of every 4 young black men is in jail, prison, or on probation, or on parole. Black men constitute 6% of the population, but 47% of the prison population. You know that the United States has more than 1 million people incarcerated today. I think like we're way ahead of any country. Is it 2 million? 2 million, right? Is it like we're way ahead of any country in the world? More than 40% of black children are growing up poor, mostly in families headed by women. In some neighborhoods, they rarely, if ever, see adult men. It costs $25,000 a year to keep a kid in prison. That's more than Job Corps or college. One teen girl in 10 gets pregnant every year. There are 20,000 homeless teenagers in New York City, which for girls generally means prostitution as a way of surviving. The number of college women who drink abusively tripled in the last 20 years to the point that as many college women as men engage in drinking to get drunk. A study conducted said that 35% of the college women polled last year said they drank to get drunk. 90% of all reported campus rapes occurred when alcohol had been used by either the assailant, the victim, or both. Nearly half of college students in the United States are binge drinkers. 44% reported binge drinking, defined as having 5 drinks in a row for men and 4 in a row for women on at least one occasion in the 2 weeks before the survey. 19% of all students were found to be frequent binge drinkers, defined as those who had at least 3 binges during that period. Crime costs Americans at least $450 billion a year, and that doesn't even count running the prisons. A violent crime is committed every 18 seconds in the United States, a rape every 5 minutes, and a murder every 24 minutes. The good news is that violent crime and homicide rate in particular was falling. I could go on and on. Yeah, there are 2 million people in prisons in the United States, okay? It exceeded 2 million. This is from the Los Angeles Times. Last year, Los Angeles led the nation in homicides, and it's estimated that over the past 20 years, some 10,000 young people have been killed. That's pretty frightening, huh? 10,000 young people have been killed. We're worried about Iraq. Okay. So, this is from Time Magazine, and it was reported about a rap group, okay? This rap group is a group called the Ghetto Boys, and the rap song that I'm reading is called Mind of a Lunatic, okay? Mind of a Lunatic. So these are the lyrics. She begged me not to kill her, I gave her a rose, then slit her throat, watched her shake till her eyes closed, had sex with the corpse before I left her, and drew my name on the wall like Helter Skelter. And this album sold 500,000 copies. Not bad, huh? Not bad. You want to buy it? Okay. Now, this is an interesting thing. This was a comparative list produced by United Way that compares the eight greatest problems facing urban public schools from 1940 and 1990. Okay, these were the eight greatest problems. Listen to this. In 1940, the first of the eight greatest problems faced by public urban public schools. Number one, running in the halls. Number two, chewing gum. Three, talking in class. Four, making noise. Five, wearing improper clothing. Six, getting out of line. Oh God. Seven, littering. And eight, the worst, smoking in the bathrooms. By 1990, the eight greatest problems facing urban public schools have become pregnancy, venereal disease, drug and alcohol abuse, suicide, rape, assault and burglary, arson, and finally, murder, gang warfare. Okay, so now you see why Mrs. Prince said this country stinks and why this other man said, you know, I'm not sure that, you know, I want my children, my grandchildren brought into this world. So it's pretty frightening and pretty scary. Now, let's turn to the source materials that you have. Okay, I didn't even mention Littletown or Virginia Tech. Eminem, the rap group, you know, that promotes violent rape, murder, pedophilia. It's unbelievable. Okay. Now let's take a look at this text. Now this is a text that most of you are familiar with, but is very, very exciting. It's probably the most boring text that you've ever read. Okay? Now if you take a look at verse 15 in Genesis 2, that's the upper left-hand corner. And the Lord God took the man and put him into the Garden of Eden to dress it and to keep it. Now, that's a colloquialism, okay? In Hebrew, it's la'ovda ulishamra, to work the land and to guard the land. Now, that's very important. The end of chapter 2, God gives the people on earth a charge. One is to work the land, that you have an obligation to work the land. The second is to protect the land, to guard the land. We are the first members of the Sierra Club. We are the first environmentalists. It's our Torah that says that you have to guard and protect the land. That's important. But remember, there are two functions. One is to work, the other is to guard. And that's important for chapter 4. Now, man knew his wife, Eve, his wife. Let's try with glasses. Maybe it'll work better. This is small print, okay? And she conceived and bore Cain. So Adam has relations with his wife, and they have a child, and the name of the child is Cain. How do you say Cain in Hebrew? Cain, Cain. And what does the name mean? Well, we'll see in a moment. Because she said, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. So Cain means to acquire. I have acquired a husband with the help of the Lord. Now that I have a son, my husband is going to feel close to me. So Cain, liknot, to acquire, to take hold of, is Cain. And again, she bore his brother Abel. How do you say Abel in Hebrew? Hevel, Hevel, Hevel. Now, why does she call him Hevel? Why does she call him Abel? What does it say in the Bible? Doesn't say. We know that Cain is called Cain because he helps her acquire a husband. He's an acquirer. But it doesn't say why the child is called Hevel. Now, what does the word Hevel mean? Who knows what the word Hevel means? Yeah. Vanity. Whoa, how do you know that? You a rabbi? That's very good, okay. Hevel means vanity. In fact, there's a book in the Bible called Ecclesiastes, Kohelet, which begins with that word, those words. Havel havalim amar Kohelet. Hakol Hevel. Vanity of vanity, everything is vanity. Remember Solomon in his old age got depressed and morose, and all he could say is, everything is vanity. Remember when he was young, he wrote about the Song of Songs, okay? Shira Shirima, Shira Lishlomo, everything was so beautiful. Ruby lips, long jet black hair. But now he's depressed, he's old. So the word Hevel means vanity. What does vanity mean? Nothing. She names the kid Nothing. Okay, that's really what she does. She names her son Nothing. It's like the boy named Sue, right? The father gives the kid a girl's name. Why? Because he grew up in a tough neighborhood. He knew he'd have to defend himself. They'd make fun of his name. He'd become a big fighter and would become strong. and he learned how to defend himself. And he meets his father, finally, you know, who deserted him when he was a little kid. And he says, why'd you name me Sue? He says, because I wanted you to defend me. So he gets up and he kills his father for naming him Sue. Okay, now that he was big and strong. In any case, Hevel literally means, you know what Hevel literally means? Hevel literally means mist, mist. Ein ha'olam mitkayem ela bezchut havel havalim shel tinokot mi beit rabban. The only reason that the world exists is for the mist, the spit that comes out of people's mouths, the children's mouths, when they learn Torah. So the whole world exists because of the mist that comes out of the children's mouth. So she names one child the acquirer, she names the other kid nothing. Nothing, you're a big nothing, you're a big loser, you're a big nothing. And Abel was a keeper of the sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. So Abel, this guy who's a vanity, a nothing, he becomes a keeper of the sheep. He has like a passive type of job. He's a watchman. You know what the pastoral scene is? You know, you go out and you have, you read poetry and you sit there and you watch the little sheep baaing, you know, and you take them to the water and you have a little flute there and you play on the chalil. You know, it's very, very spiritual. Moses was a shepherd and David was a shepherd and they became great spiritual people. That's what a spiritual person does. And the other was Cain was a tiller of the ground. Okay, so he had to work. He had to plow. He had to build those furrows. He had to plant. He had to deal with infestation. You know what being an agriculturist is like. You never know if your crops are going to succeed or not. That's, you know, it's a terrible thing. You could be at the point of reaping the crops and all of a sudden something comes and destroys the whole crop. Now, also, I want to point out that one is a keeper, right? And the other is a worker. Oved, right? God said, work the land and guard the land, okay? So one is working and one is guarding. That's important to note. Now, according to tradition, Cain and Abel were twins. Does anybody see a hint in the text that shows us that Cain and Abel were twins? Anybody? Take a look. What does it say? And she conceived and bore Cain and said, and again she bore his brother Abel. What's missing? What's missing? What? Another meeting with the husband. What word is missing? One word. Conceived, okay? It only says conceived. Once there were two children. So there's one conception, two children, so according to tradition, they were twins. And in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering unto the Lord. So he had a good crop, he wanted to thank God, and he brings an offering of the fruit of the ground. He didn't bring anything special, just whatever grew. He happened to pass by, picked up a banana, he picked up an apple, he picked up an orange, okay? And he brought it to God. And Abel, he also brought of the firstlings of the flock and of the fat thereof. So Abel made a special effort to bring really something special, the best flocks, okay? And the Lord had respect unto Abel and to his offering, but unto Cain and to his offering he had no respect. According to tradition, they put these offerings on the altar and they sent them up in a column of smoke. The column of smoke of Abel's offering went direct up, but of Cain's offering was blown away. So he knew that his offering had been rejected. So, and Cain was very wroth, and his countenance fell. And the Lord said unto Cain, why art thou wroth? And why is thy countenance falling? If thou doest well, shall it not be lifted up? And if thou doest not well, sin coucheth at the door. And unto thee is its desire, but thou mayest rule over it. So you made a mistake. So you made an error. You know that when people get into the groove of making mistakes, you get caught into that groove. But you can repent. You can do better. Next time you'll bring a better offering. It really depends on what's in your heart. Someone can bring a little, but he brings it with a full heart. That's good enough. But don't get caught in the groove. Aveira goreret aveira. Sin brings along, schleps along another sin. Mitzvah goreret mitzvah. A good deed can bring in the next good deed. So you can repent. You can lift your countenance up. That's the end of the story. So Abel, who is the religionist, the spiritualist, he brings this great offering. It's accepted. Cain, the man or the tiller of the ground, his offering is not. And Cain spoke unto Abel, his brother, and it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and slew him. So they're talking in the field. We don't know what they're talking about. Apparently some argument. Cain rises up and kills Abel. So the rabbis speculate about what they were talking about. You know, Nebuch. Cain and Abel were the only two heirs to the greatest inheritance on the face of the earth. They were going to inherit everything that Adam and Eve owned, and they were the only two heirs. So they were going to inherit seven continents. So they're probably arguing over, you know, who's going to get Las Vegas? Who's going to be stuck with the Sahara Desert, you know? Who's going to get Monaco? Who's going to be stuck with Jerusalem, you know? Stuff like that. You know, when you have a lot of wealth, leads to wars. That's what battles are all about. Okay? And then, some speculate that it was over religion, because one's offering was accepted, the other offering was rejected. What do people fight about? The Muslims hate the Catholics hate the Buddhists hate the Jews. Everybody hates the Jews, okay? So that's what wars are about, religious wars, religious doctrine. There are those that say, and this is interesting, that since there was only one woman in the world, Eve, there was only one woman who could give birth to the next generation. So they were fighting over the favor of Eve. Yeah, there's a Medrash, the legend says, you know, that every time a male child was born, a female child was born, and that's who they married. But, you know, from the text, you see that there's only one woman there. And they're fighting over the love of their mother. And Cain rises up and kills Abel. So what are wars fought over? Love, you know. Knights of the Round Table, Lancelot, etc., etc. Okay. So, and the Lord said unto Cain, where is Abel thy brother? And he thought he'd be cute, you know, because remember, in chapter 2, God gave the human being two charges, one to be a keeper and the other to be a worker. So he says, I'm the worker. He's the keeper. You got to ask him where he is, okay? So he says, I know not. Am I my brother's keeper? Remember, I'm a tiller of the ground. He's the shepherd. God didn't go for that too much. And he says, and God says, what hast thou done? The voice of thy brother's blood crieth to me from the ground, because the earth is polluted by murder, by the blood. And now curseth art thou from the ground, which hath opened up her mouth to receive thy brother's blood from thy hand. When thou tillest the ground, from now on, it shall not henceforth yield unto thee her strength. You can work and work and work. The earth will not yield to you. You'll never be able to earn a living from working the land again. A fugitive and a wanderer shall thou be in the earth, because the earth has rejected you. It's vomited you out. And Cain said unto the Lord, my punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, thou hast driven me out this day from the face of the land, and from thy face shall I be hid. And I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer in the earth, and it will come to pass that whosoever findeth me will slay me. And the Lord said unto him, unto Cain, therefore, whosoever slayeth Cain, anyone who kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken upon him sevenfold. He'll be avenged by God seven times over. And the Lord set a sign on Cain, lest any finding him should smite him. So everybody knew the sign of Cain, that you're not allowed to touch him. Okay, so poor, let's see what happens here, okay? The murderer is alive and well, and the religionist, the spiritualist, is dead. Okay, let's see what happens to this murderer. And Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod. What does Nod mean? Nov and Nod. What does it mean? It means like rocking. The land that rocks. The land that swayed. Okay? Because what? The earth rejected him. Wherever he walked, the earth rejected him. On the east of Eden. You know, that's probably where Carole King came up with that song. I feel the earth move under my feet. I feel the sky. Okay. Anyway. And Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch. Okay? So Cain has a wife, and she conceives, and she has a child by the name of Enoch. How do you say Enoch in Hebrew? Anybody know? Chanoch. Oh, boy, you know too much. Okay. Okay. Chanoch. Chanoch sounds like some holiday that we have. But what time of the year? I won't even tell you. What holiday? Chanukah, very good guess. Okay, Chanukah. And what does the word Chanukah mean? What does Chanukah mean? Miracle. Miracle. Nope.
Camp on the 25th.
Okay, so you, now that's what the substance of it is, but not that's not what the or meaning of it is, okay? So that's the acronym, dedication, okay? Chanoch means to dedicate, okay? To dedicate. How do you say Jewish education in Hebrew? Chinuch, because you dedicate a person to education, chinuch, okay? So Chanoch means, Enoch means to dedicate. He's dedicating his son to a very, very important ideal that he believes in. Let's see what that ideal is. And he named his son Enoch. And he, Cain, builded a city and called the name of the city after the name of his son Enoch. So what was Cain's obsession? Cain's obsession was to become the Donald Trump of the ancient Near East, to build cities all over the place, and to give his son a place to live in, to dedicate his life to real estate, to buildings, to skyscrapers. Why would Cain do a thing like that? Why would Cain obsessed with building cities? What?
To fight the land?
To defeat the land a little more? Because when a parent grows up and had a lifetime of deprivation, what does he do? He tries to make sure that his child does not suffer the same deprivation. And what was Cain's deprivation? He had no place to sleep. The earth rolled him over. Not a single place to put his body down. Every night he had to be in a different place. So he's building for his son skyscrapers, high-rises, dwelling places, so that God forbid my poor son, my poor child, Chanoch, would not have a place to live. He doesn't have one place to live. He has thousands of dwellings now to live. So he's dedicating himself to that ideal. So the murderer becomes the great urban developer. Look at that. And where is the spiritualist? Where's the spiritualist? 6 feet under, pushing daisies. He's dead. You don't hear a thing from him. No children, no nothing. It's interesting, okay? And Enoch. And unto Enoch was born Irad, and Irad begat Mechuyal, Mechuyal begat Methusael, Methusael begat Lemech. So this is now 5 generations later. Lemech is born, okay? Lemech, the great-great-great-grandson of the murderer Cain. And you know, in Yiddish there's an expression, you call somebody, right, a Lemech. What does it mean when you call someone a Lemech? You're a Lemechel. What does it mean?
Ineffective.
Ineffective? More than that. You're a wimp. You're just a wimp. Okay, that's what a lemach means. You're a loser, you're a wimp. Now, this is peripheral to our discussion tonight, but we're going to find out why lemach was called lemach, okay? Why that name stuck to him. Okay, so listen to this. And lemach took unto him 2 wives. Doesn't sound too wimpy to me. Okay, and the name of the one was Ada, and the name of the other was Tzila. According to tradition, Ada was supposed to be for procreation, and Tzila was supposed to be for beauty. She was not supposed to become pregnant. And Ada bore Jabal, okay, that's Yaval. He was the father of such that dwell in tents and have cattle. So he was the great urban rancher, the Hunt brothers of Texas. He had herds and herds of cattle. If you wanted to go away for a weekend in a farm setting on a dude ranch, you'd call up 1-800-YABAL and you'd go away for the weekend there. He was the great, great rancher. The murderer, okay? This is the murderer's grandson. Yabal was the father of such as dwell in tents and have cattle. And his brother's name was Jubal. And he was the father of all such as handled the harp and the pipe. Listen to this. Out of the murderer comes the father of music, of aesthetics, of poetry, of architecture, of violin, of composition. Is the murderer, urban developer, cattle ranches, music, poetry, fine arts, literature. And Selah, that was the wife who wasn't supposed to become pregnant, but didn't work, she also bore Tubal-Cain. Now, all of the children's names are based on this root of Yud Bet Lamed Yabal, Yabal, Tubal, Tubal, except that this child is also given a second name, Tubal-Cain. So his mother or his father has no embarrassment about naming their child after the world's greatest murderer, the person who killed 1/4 of all the people on the face of the earth. So they named the child after the great-grandfather, Cain. And look what happens to this child. What does he become an expert in? And Tubal-Cain became the forger of every cutting instrument, the brass and iron. So what does he become? He becomes the great arms manufacturer. He develops a spear and a bayonet and a bow and an arrow and gunpowder and nuclear armaments. He's the father of the greatest mass destruction. He makes it possible now not to kill one person with a blow of the hand, but to kill thousands of people. It was inevitable that the grand, great grandson, a descendant of the first murderer, would develop the art of murder far more than the grandfather. And where's Hevel? He's a nothing, the mist. Nothing. We don't hear from him. The spiritualist, the man who gave that beautiful offering to God, the fat, the firstlings thereof, nothing. Strange. Now let's see why Lemach is called the Lemach. And the sister of Tubal-Cain was Naama. Here, for the first time, they name a girl, you know, so she must have been an exceptional girl, according to tradition. Who was this exceptional girl? Anybody know? Naama was who? Who said that? Who said that? She said that? She did time in the beginner service. Okay. Okay. And you should buy her record. What's it called? Come Home. Buy her record. I listened to it this week. It's great. The CD. Okay. Tubal-Cain, Naama, according to tradition, was Noah's wife. Okay. So Lemach said unto his wife. Now, according to tradition, Lemach was blind. And for a blind person, he had a very unusual hobby. He loved to hunt. Not easy being a blind hunter, okay? He loved to hunt, okay? So he goes out with his son Tubal-Cain, who's the expert in weaponry. And Tubal-Cain takes him into the forest, and he sees a deer, and he says, Dad, lift up the bow, you know, to the right, to the left, you know, up, down, pull back, release, okay? And that's the way they hunted. One day, they're out in the forest, and they're hunting. And Tubal-Cain gives him instructions, up, right, down, and okay, pull back, release, let's go see the kill. They go see the kill, and Tubal-Cain says to his father, he says, Dad, I got bad news. It's not a deer. It's Grandpa. It's Cain. We just killed Cain. So remember, Lemach is blind. And what do you do when you find out such news? What do you say? Oi, gewalt, right? That's what you say. Yeah, gewalt, okay. And what do you do when you say oi, gewalt? You clasp your hands like this, okay? Oi, gewalt! So he screams out oi, gewalt. He clasps his hands. He doesn't realize that his son Tubal-Cain's head is right between his hands. And he kills his son right there. Okay? So he comes back after killing his grandfather and his son. And he sings the following poem to his wife. And Lemach said unto his wife, Wives, Adah and Zilah, hear my voice. Ye wives of Lemach, hearken unto my speech. For I have slain a man for wounding me, and a young man for bruising me. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, truly Lemach, 70 and sevenfold. Okay, so Lemach is called a Lemach, or that name, you know, of a wimp, of a jerk, because he had no business hunting, you know, when he was blind. But the problem still remains. The Bible here in the first four chapters of the Torah is telling us, hey, look, the spiritualist is dead. And the murderer is the creative force on the face of the earth. He's the urban developer. He has the ranches and cattle and dude ranches. He's music and art and implements of metal. And the other guy, nothing. So what is the Bible telling us? Is the Bible telling us, you know, that creativity, you know, can only be done by violence? To a certain extent, yes. Because all creativity takes a toll on the environment. You know that. That you want to, you know, invent the wheel, it's going to mar the ground. You know, if you want to make an internal combustion engine, it's going to mar the environment. And everything, every advance, human advance, scientific advance, generally takes its toll. There is a certain amount of violence that's involved in it, whether on the environment, whether on the people, etc. And the question is, how do you become creative and produce a society where there is the minimum amount of violence? How do you remain moral in an increasingly immoral environment? How do you do it? And what it's saying is, ladies and gentlemen, read everything from chapter 4 until the end of the book of Deuteronomy, and that's the answer. The answer is the Bible. Study the five books of the Bible. The question is raised here in chapter 4. How do you remain moral? How do you become creative and produce in this world and not become immoral? And the answer is found in the Bible. And what's the answer of the Bible? The Jewish people have a very, very, very unique and revolutionary answer. You know, if you want to become an expert in any skill, you want to become a carpenter, you want to become a plumber, you want to become a driver, you want to become a lawyer, you want to become a basketball player, you want to become a violinist, you want to become a rabbi, in every single profession, you have to practice those skills. You have to go through a regimen of training. Yes, there are people that are born incredibly talented. Yasha Heifetz was born incredibly talented with a perfect pitch, ear, unbelievably, fingers, whatever it was. But he didn't become a violinist by saying, I feel like a great violinist in my heart. He had to practice. And you know that Yasha Heifetz practices scales. Scales! Scales! Not the difficult musical compositions, for 6 hours every single day. Scales, la 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 la, so that his timing is right. You want to be the greatest basketball player of all times, Michael Jordan. Sure, he's born talented, he's born with certain strengths, etc., reflexes, whatever it may be. But he had to practice those skills. And if you see the professional basketball players, they don't practice their crazy shots, their remarkable shots. They practice their set shots and their jump shots and their layups so that their timing is correct. They have to practice, 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 practice. And that's what Western education believes in. That if you want to master a certain skill, you have to practice. And you have to practice the fundamentals. And you never, never stop practicing. You want to be a great doctor? You have to continue practicing. You have to continue studying. Be a great Torah scholar? You have to continue studying. Otherwise, you fall backwards. There's only one area where Western civilization says that you don't have to practice in order to master the skill. Isn't that strange? And you know what that area is? Ethics and morality. Ethics and morality. You want to get into the best university in the United States and the world, you have to, you know, take your SATs, you have to have a good language arts, you have to have good math arts, you know, science skills. You know, you score your 600s, you get your perfect scores, you have a good grade average, you get a letter of recommendation from your teachers. You could be a lowlife, you could be a decadent person, you could be a person who goes into the supermarkets just to slam the doors into the little old ladies' faces and to trip them up, you know. You could be a drug salesperson to little kids, and you can get into the finest universities. Why? Because ethics and morality are not on your report card. Oh, how do you become ethical and moral? Oh, that happens by osmosis. You learn at home, your parents show you. Well, a lot of people don't have parents who are going to show them. Oh, we'll see some films of Joan of Arc, this woman who gave of herself for the life of her people, etc. We'll read the sonnets of Shakespeare, we'll become ethical and moral people. Judaism says that's hogwash, that's garbage. In order to become ethical and moral, you have to practice and practice and practice, just like to become a basketball player or a person who plays the violin, or to become a doctor or a lawyer. It doesn't happen by osmosis. It doesn't happen by accident. And that's where Judaism differs from Christianity, because that's exactly where it differed. That's why Western civilization follows that pattern. Why should they have such a lacuna? Why should they have made such a mistake? Because Christianity made that mistake by saying that you no longer need the rituals of Judaism, because now Jesus has died for us and all you need is baptism and faith. And Judaism said, no, you need to keep kosher. You need to have Shabbat. You need circumcision. You need to wash your hands. You need to make a motzi. You need to bread. You need to have the festivals. You need to have the rituals. Because it's those rituals that make a difference. And without those rituals, it doesn't work. What am I talking about? What am I talking about? So Judaism has a ritual. And I'm going to use an extreme example. You wake up in the morning, the first thing you do is supposed to wash your hands. First thing you do is say Modan. You say, thank you God for restoring my soul. It doesn't have God's name in it. You just say, I thank you. I am thankful. That's what you say. doesn't have God's name in it, so even if your hands are not clean, you can say that prayer for restoring my soul. Then you run, wash your hands right, left, right, left, right, left, because you've been in a state of death virtually. Unconsciousness is the closest thing to death. So you wash your hands just like when you come back from the cemetery. Not when like you're washing for bread to purify your hands or to sanctify your hands, but this is to cleanse from death. And then the code of Jewish law tells you exactly what to do. You know, how to put on your clothes, etc., etc., you know, to take the steps, etc. And it even tells you how to put on your shoes. Code of Jewish law tells you how to put on your shoes. And it says, if you're wearing lace shoes, you're supposed to put your right shoe on first. Don't tie it. Put on your left shoe. Tie your left shoe, go back to your right shoe. Now, if that isn't obsessive compulsive behavior, then I don't know. Okay. I mean, it's crazy. Who cares? Who puts on what shoe, what foot, you know, ties what? Why? Why does the code of Jewish law say that? Because you don't want to hurt the feelings of your left foot. You favored the right foot by putting on the right foot first, shoe first. Then you're going to tie the right shoe before the left shoe. That's not fair. Well, I'll tell you. You know, I wear loafers most of the time. And I always put on my right shoe first, and my left foot has never complained to me. Look, Walt, what are you doing, you know? But what's the point? The point is that even with shoes, an inanimate object, or feet that don't, as far as we know yet, don't have feelings, we're supposed to be sensitive so that in your interface with people during the day, with men and women, with students, with friends, with associates, be fair, be equitable. Don't favor one child over the next unfairly. Don't favor one person over the other unfairly. And it trains you consciously when you put on your shoes. How much more so should you feel for human beings who have feelings? One of the customs on Friday night is that when you make the kiddush, you cover the challis, you cover the bread. One of the reasons for that is because when the manna came down from heaven, which is why we have the double bread on Friday, because it came down double loaves, double portions of manna, dew covered it to keep it fresh. So you put a cover over it, just like the dew. But another reason that's given is because you're giving all the attention to the wine, you're making kiddush over the wine, and you don't want to hurt the challis feelings. So you cover the challis feelings so they won't see the attention that you're giving the wine. Give out. Rabbi Israel Salanter was the father of the ethical school movement in Judaism. Once went to someone's house for Shabbos, and the host's wife had forgotten to cover the challis on Friday night. So the host screamed at his wife, "Hey, you forgot to cover for the challis." So Salanter said, "You blew the whole point of the ritual. You mean you feel more for the challis feelings than your wife's feelings? You blew the whole thing." And that's why you have people who are known as orthoprax Jews. Orthoprax. They practice Judaism. They wrap themselves up in challis and tefillin. But they cheat in business because they don't understand the purpose of the rituals. The rituals are supposed to teach us a lesson. So you have this guy who decides he's going to be the next Michael Jordan, the next great basketball player in the world. And he starts practicing, goes into the schoolyard. He practices, he takes the ball, he shoots it into the basket. 10%, 15%, 25%, 50%, 75%, 80% of his shots go in. Unbelievable. The guy is so incredibly talented. And they say, okay, let's play a full court basketball game. He's never played full court basketball. He doesn't know what the rules are. He sees a basket on this side, he shoots. He shoots, sees a basket on this side for the opposing team, he shoots too. That's what an orthoprax Jew is. He doesn't realize that there are rules here. You're supposed to score for God. You're supposed to score for morality. You're supposed to, these rituals are supposed to leave us somewhere to help us. It's not just arbitrary exercises. That's not what we're not doing then. And let me tell you something. Rituals work. They really, really work. And Judaism has proven to be the most effective method of educating people for moral and ethical living over long periods of time with large numbers of people. Yeah, there's someone in the Himalayas, you know, that has a group of 10 people and they're contemplating their navels, you know, and they're living a very ethical life. But how do you educate and convey those feelings to thousands and millions of people? And we have succeeded in doing that. That's what Judaism is all about. It's true. Hammurabi had in his code, thou shalt not murder, 300 years before the Bible. But it was the Bible that said, thou shalt not murder doesn't mean that I kill another person, you can kill, I can kill a third. In other words, if I kill my neighbor's son, you can come and kill my son. That's the way Hammurabi had it. If I killed my neighbor's slave, I could give him 18 camels, we'd be even. If I raped my neighbor's daughter, he could come take my daughter as a concubine or rape my daughter. That was Hammurabi. Judaism said, no, every person is responsible for his own sins. You can't take a third innocent person. We revolutionized the world. The world abides by our way of morality. It's not Judeo-Christian morality. It's Judeo-morality. We taught the world environmentalism. We were there first. It's our Torah that says you're not allowed to cut down the fruit-bearing tree in times of war to divert the waterworks. It's our Torah that says that a soldier has to carry a spade with him to get rid of the waste. It's a revolutionary. I talked about this last week. These are the rituals that make the difference. Now let me tell you something. And frankly, I'm embarrassed to tell this to you, but it's a true story. I say it happened about 25, 27 years ago. I was teaching at Ramaz. I was a young teacher then, not Ramaz. I was teaching at Lincoln Square Synagogue. And I had my introduction to Bible class. And a young woman came into the class. She was about 16, 17 years old, very beautiful. And she was somewhat troubled. And the next term she came with her non-Jewish boyfriend whose name was Shorty. Her mother called me up. I don't know what to do. She's going out with this non-Jewish guy. Can you do something? I tried my best. Anyway, she came into the class with Shorty. And within 5 minutes of my talking, beginning to speak, Shorty used to fall asleep and used to snore rather loudly. And then at the end of the class, he would wake up and he says, oh, Rabbi, what a great class. What a wonderful class. I feel so good. I'm so energized. And I felt like bottling the class and selling it for insomniacs, stuff like that. Anyway, they signed up for another term, and I tried working on them, and it just didn't help. And I called this, that, they wouldn't respond, and I gave up. 2 years later, I guess the girl was now about 20 years old, I get an invitation in the mail that she's getting married. And she's getting married at 770 Eastern Parkway, which is the headquarters of World Lubavitch. She's now a Lubavitcher. And the name of the groom is a Jewish name. I rejoiced. I said to my wife, Adel, I have to go to this wedding. I can't pass it up. Are you kidding? After what I knew? So I travel out to Crown Heights, to Eastern Parkway. And before the wedding, they have what's called the Kabbalat Panim, where they sign the ketubah and they veil the bride. And that's in the Brooklyn Jewish Center, which is like a long block away from 770 Eastern Parkway. So I go into this room, and it's a crowded room about this size, very, very, very crowded. And the groom is being marched in now to the bride, who's sitting radiantly. She was really stunningly beautiful on a chair in the front of the room. The room was very crowded. There were no chairs, no benches. It was really, shoulder to shoulder. So they had to part the way in order for the groom to go down. And I saw that it took the groom a very, very long time to make it down the aisle. And then I saw how he struggled to veil the bride. The groom had cerebral palsy. And it was so heartrending to see him struggle to veil the bride. Knowing the past history of the bride, I was just so emotionally drained. She looked so radiant, it was so beautiful, and I was so happy for them. But God. And, the Hasidim have the custom of using an opaque veil for the bride. It's like a cloth, and you really can't see anything, and then afterwards the bride is led on either side. She can have looked down, but she can't see ahead of her. So they have this opaque cloth. And standing behind me in this crowded room are, a bunch of obviously two secular women who are looking at this ceremony. And one of them is talking rather loudly, offensively, and she says, look at what they're doing to that poor child. Look at that rag that they're putting on her face. This is primitive. This is barbaric. This is inhuman. And she's going on and on and on and on. And I'm an emotional wreck. And I'm crying. And she's going on and on. So, I'm from the Bronx. And I turned around and I said to her, probably the most offensive word that I could say to her publicly. I like growled at her and I said, "Lady, rawr, lady." Had this ceremony been taking place in the Himalayas with a guru presiding, you would have said, "Oh, how interesting, how intriguing, I wonder what that means." You would have tried to find some understanding of it. But because it's Jewish, you have nothing but disdain for it. She was like taken aback, you know. And she said to me something that was true about 27 years ago. She looked at me and she said, Young man, I'll have you know that I feel like a very good Jew in my heart. So there." I should have just shut up. But I'm from the Bronx. And I don't know why I said it. I regret saying it to this day, but I'm going to tell you what I said. I said to her, "Lady, feeling like a good Jew in your heart doesn't make you any more a good Jew than feeling like an astronaut in your heart puts you on the moon." She slapped me. No. You know, we like parted ways. And then after the wedding, there was a receiving line, and the bride's parents were welcoming guests, and I was on the line, and that was Rabbi Buchwald. It's so nice to see you. I'd like you to meet the bride's aunt. I said, "We've met," and I apologized. Now, the truth of the matter is, okay, this is important. The truth of the matter is that feeling like a good Jew in your heart is very important, because if you don't have that first step, you can't get anywhere. But it can't be enough. It can't be enough. Behind the good Jew in your heart, you have to do those rituals. Those rituals really work. It makes a big difference. Kosher makes a big difference. Lighting candles makes a big difference. Praying and saying blessings make a big difference. Doing acts of charity, giving charity makes a big difference. Welcoming guests into your home makes a big difference. It doesn't happen by osmosis. You have to train and train and rigorously train, and you can't give up. I had a wonderful rabbi in Yeshiva University aside from Rabbi Soloveitchik. His name is Rabbi Aaron Kreiser. He was one of the great rabbis of the generation, but people didn't know him. Eventually, when he retired from Yeshiva University, he went to Lakewood, and he became like this world-renowned scholar. And he survived the Holocaust by going to Shanghai with the Mir Yeshiva. Jewish community went to China, and they were saved there. And in Shanghai, he had a study partner that he studied with, who eventually became a very prosperous caterer. And day after I graduated Yeshiva and came to Lincoln Square Synagogue, I got a call from Rabbi Kreiser. He says, "Brian, you have to do me a favor." I said, "Anything, Rebbe." He says, "My best friend from Shanghai, my study partner, his son went off the path. He's no longer religious. He's no longer observant. Will you help me?" So I tried to beg off to explain to him, you know, my area of specialty of expertise is dealing with people with little or no background. What do I know about this kid? Has been learning. He's 18, 20 years old. His whole life in yeshiva, he probably knows more than I do. What am I going to say to him? What am I going to do with him? You know, it's sort of like, you know, if you go to a doctor today, you know, go to an orthopedist, and you come with a broken finger, and the orthopedist says to you, "I only treat tennis elbows." You know, they're all specialists. Everybody's a specialist. So I wanted to say I'm a specialist. What am I going to do with this guy? I tried, but it didn't work. He says, "Don't worry. God will help you." So I meet the guy, and the guy has body language, you know, like, you know, "I want to meet you, like I want to get, you know, drilled in my head." And we talk a little bit, and I say, "Look," I say, "Chaim, I don't have any program for you. The only thing I know is, you know, for people little no background. But I want to make you a deal. You're being harassed by your parents. You can't live in your parents' house. It's horrible. Your life is horrible. I'll make you a deal. If you come for 4 weeks to my introduction to Bible class on Tuesday nights, and you spend four consecutive Shabbatot with me in my home and come to the beginner service on Shabbos, I'll speak to your parents and I'll tell them not to bug you anymore. Whatever happens, it works, doesn't work. So he says, are you crazy? He says to me, I'm going to go to a Bible class in English. I know the Bible by heart. I'm going to go to a prayer service in English. Are you crazy? I said, look, you want your parents to leave you alone? It's a deal? It's a deal. So he comes the first Tuesday night to this Bible class. And in the Bible class, you know, we have all sorts of unusual people. There was the producer of Kate and Alley. There was a famous composer. There was editors of a whole bunch of magazines, the New York Times reporters. It was very, very interesting class that comes. And they're having the time of their lives, arguing, ripping apart the scriptures like we did tonight, you know, just to try to understand. And they're arguing and screaming at each other. This guy never saw that before, you know. To him, you know, opening up a Bible was like boring as could be. And then on Shabbos, you know, again, interesting people with little or no background fighting. What do you need a mechitza? And, you know, God is wrong and this and that. They're going crazy and fighting. We have all sorts of fighting. Amalek, how do you justify Amalek? Animal sacrifices, servitude in the Bible, this, and they're screaming at each other, you know, and they're ripping me apart. And looks like fun. And he comes back the next Tuesday and he, like, starts asking questions himself, all those questions that they wouldn't allow him to ask in yeshiva. And on Saturday, all of a sudden, he becomes animated. He starts asking the questions about the weekly portion and stuff like that. To make a long story short, with a little bit of therapy, and after 6 months, he became observant again. And after a year, he was engaged to a Jewish girl. And they were going to get married in Barapak this time. And it was going to be in the Gruss Educational Center, which is a modern building, but it's a school building. You know, his parents were prosperous caterers. They could have had in the fanciest hotels, but they wanted to have a modest wedding. They were members of the Mir community. And the school building has a beautiful ballroom, lunchroom, you know, with a chandelier. But the chuppah, the wedding ceremony, took place in the gym. It was winter. And I was still teaching my class. It was a Tuesday night. So I came late, just as they let out the people from the chuppah. And the lobby was packed, and I'm looking for a place to hang up my coat. And there's like no hangers. Half the coats are on the floor. Finally find a hanger. I hang up my coat. And before I turn around, some guy comes up to me, and he sticks his hand into my face like this, you know? I look around. I realize that he's looking for a contribution. I reach into my pocket, I take out a dime, a quarter, and I give him a coin. Before he pulls his hand away, there were five more hands. I look around, and the whole lobby is like swarming with collectors, with schnorrers. Couldn't believe it. And I notice that all the guests are giving bills. Not coins, bills. I noted it, and went down to the ballroom. Come down to the ballroom, and in the ballroom, there are tables, separate seating, men and women, and there's two beautifully long appointed tables in the front. One on one side, the men's side, one on the other side. Who's sitting at the tables? The poor people. Torn clothes, shopping bags, shopping baskets, shopping carts, smelly. And they're sitting up front, beautiful tables, because the parents felt that they couldn't make a simcha, a joyous affair, without inviting the poor people to be part of it. So they were honored guests. I sat down at my table. I didn't know anybody, all men. After the first course, a young man stands up. He says, my name is so-and-so, and I have taken upon myself, it was in the month of Adar, I've taken upon myself to support a poor family in Jerusalem for Passover. And he says this, and I expect you all to give. He didn't say, I'd like you all to give. I expect you all to give. Thought that was unusual. I take out my wallet. I said, listen, I'm in some weird place. I take out my wallet. I take out a $5 bill. I wave it in front of everybody at the table to show how generous I am. And I plop it into his hand to be the first one. Nobody gave less than 20 except for me. I mean, I was astounded. And then after the next course, a group of young men dressed in pink rabbit's uniform, come out, and they start doing a dance to the music, and then they go from table to table with little cards. We are students of the Mir Yeshiva, and in the month of Adar, we go around all the joyous occasions to collect money for moskitim, for wine and matzahs for poor people for Passover. I never saw such an outpouring of charity, and I tell you, I came back a different person. This community, the Mir community, was committed to charity that I have never seen. Now, I live on the Upper East Side, on the Upper West Side. Doorman building, fancy, schmancy. Now, there's one thing worse than being on a mafia hit list. You know, you're on a mafia hit list, they come, they tie you up, they shoot you in the head, it's over instantly, they put you in those concrete shoes, they throw you into the river, and it's finished, it's over. But if you're on the charity collector's hit list, it's torture, and torture, and torture, never-ending torture. Once they get your name and address, they come at all times of day and night at the most inconvenient time. I had a doorman who had a nervous breakdown because of that. He says, "Rabbi, the fuzzies are coming, they're here, you know." So, you know, fortunately, I'm out, you know, and Murray Hill giving classes every night. My poor wife has to face the music, you know. And they come into the house, they traipse into the house, you know, with the blood, with the dirt, with the snow, with the mud, you know. And not all of them are very nice, you know, they demand their money. Some of them come with a, you know, canceled check from last year, and they say, "How could you give me $10? You gave me $18. Here's the check." You know, and they have change. You know, and some of them are even frauds. Some of them alter the checks. You know, they'll change an $18 to $78. You know, they're fakes. They're frauds. And it's very, very difficult and very, very painful. Sometimes, you know, they come en masse like three or four at a time, and it's really painful. But after this experience at this wedding, I said to myself, when I spoke with my wife, I said, "I'll tell you what I saw there, you won't believe it, but we have to start handling the charity differently." So first of all, we stopped giving checks, we only had cash because we didn't want people to defraud us, okay? Then we asked the person to sit down. We'd offer them coffee or cake, ask them what they're collecting for. Now they have certificates to show that they're legitimate, most of them. You know, they're supposed to have certificates that they come with. And to treat them like a mensch. To treat them with dignity. And when we write out large numbers of checks to charity, we had the children sitting there to help us make decisions. How do you give charity? They would stamp the envelopes and lick the envelopes and put the checks into the envelopes. It makes a big difference. It doesn't happen by osmosis. They have to be involved. And they knew where the money was, so in case someone came, they could reach to the envelope and take the envelope and give them charity also. It doesn't just happen by osmosis. There's a man in our synagogue who was in a car accident when he was 21 years old and he's brain damaged. And if you look at him, he looks weird. And even though he has an apartment on the west side, he sleeps in the street or at 770 or under the highway. He's weird. Very smart, very smart. He's been coming to our house for the last 30 years every Wednesday night. He used to come at 6 or 7 o'clock to have dinner. Then he started showing up at 9, 10 o'clock. Then he comes at 1, 2 o'clock. We leave the door open. And he watches some television or goes onto the computer. It's not easy. And it's a tribute to my wife. But that makes a big difference. And when someone is evicted, we've had people stay in a house. They were supposed to stay for a week. They stayed for a month. Stayed for 3 months. Not so easy. But it makes a difference when the children see it. That's what we're talking about. The rituals really make a difference. And that's really what Judaism is all about. And the Jewish people have been successful in conveying this message to the world without holy wars, without saying "kiss the mug and dove it or I'll chop off your head," without intifadas, without crusades. We've done it by modeling. And only if we remain models can this truly be successful. I want to tell you one final thing. You don't have to believe in God in order for this system to work. If God came down to me and said, "Buchwald, your whole life has been a fraud. There is no God. There is no God. I don't think I would change my lifestyle very much. I want to be able to kiss my children on Friday night. I believe in the efficacy of kashrut, that if I'm going to eat meat where I've taken the life of an animal, I'm not going to outrageously defile that meat by drinking milk with it, which would have sustained the life of an animal. I believe it's important to have those rituals, to say a blessing, to thank whatever spirits there may be, that I have food and water and clothes and shelter and a comfortable life. I think it's important to give children an education so that the next generation can carry on those virtues, those morals. Prophet Jeremiah says, Oti azhu mekor mayim chayim. You have forsaken me, a source of living water. Lachpor lehem borot, to dig for yourself systems. Borot nishparim asher lo yakilu amayim, that don't even hold waters. What are we giving it up for? For what? For broken systems? Look at this world today. Look around you. Tell me, does the world need those rituals more than ever today? Even the rituals is no guarantee. There's no guarantee that a person who even does it sincerely is going to wind up ethical and moral, because, you know, 99.44% of our stimuli is against it. Everybody's saying, you know, get more money, get the beautiful woman, you know, take the shortcut, cut corners. Doesn't matter if you hurt anybody. Sock it to him. Do it your own way. We need to overdose. We need to overdose on goodness and kindness. And that's what happens when you live a life of Jewish rituals. You're basically overdosing. You're going to the extreme so that eventually you can become balanced. And that's why I plead with you and I say to you, if you remember anything, just remember those two words. Rituals work. They really do work. It's not enough to feel like a good Jew in your heart. You have to do something about it. And if you do something about it, you will wind up a transformed person. So I thank you very much for hanging there in with me. These were not two easy lectures. Next week, well, there's only one, okay? Next week is sexuality. And it won't be that long. Let me remind you that tomorrow night is Purim. There is a mitzvah tomorrow night to hear the Megillah, to celebrate tomorrow night. Don't overdo it, okay? Remember that the advice is that you're supposed to drink until you don't know the difference between Mordecai and Haman, but up to the point where you don't know, not beyond the point. Remember that you should not drive if you're going to drink. And remember that on Purim Day, you have a number of mitzvot. One is to give two immediately edible food substances, like an apple and a piece of cake, to another Jewish person on Purim Day. That's Friday, not Thursday night. And to give matanot levyonim, to give charity to two poor people. They don't have to be Jewish people, okay? To give charity, even if it's a penny, to poor people. And also to have a su'udah, to have a meal, preferably before noontime, which is about Jewish time, it's about one now. Okay, so you have to have a meal, even preferably with meat, on Friday morning. And then, of course, Shabbos comes in and we celebrate Shabbat. So I wish you all a very, very happy Purim. It happened in Gelhofen. Just from drinking thrice too often. And there's only one thing more that must be said. At your Purim celebration, use a little moderation, or you'll wind up with a grogger for a head.